WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. That music is a piece called Slipping, and it is by one of our morning show guests today, renowned composer Alex Shapiro, who is right here in southeastern Wisconsin, far away from her home of Washington State, because she has been invited here by Dr. James Ripley on the music faculty of Carthage College to compose a piece which has been commissioned to celebrate the 140th anniversary of the bands of Carthage College. And tomorrow night, Saturday night, 7:30 p.m., in a concert at 7:30 p.m., the commissioned work of Alex Shapiro, Liquid Compass, will receive its world premiere. And I am so delighted that on WGTD's morning show today, we can speak with composer Alex Shapiro and with Dr. James Ripley, who is Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage College. He will be conducting most of Saturday night's concert, including the world premiere of Liquid Compass. Dr. Ripley, Alex Shapiro, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
It's great to be here.
Good morning,
Greg.
This is
really fun.
good to have you here, and lovely to have this opportunity to connect and to talk about the business of composing and about this really exciting commission. Dr. Ripley, maybe we can start by hearing from you the connection between the two of you and the invitation which you ultimately extended to Alex Shapiro.
We've had the great opportunity to bring a number of composer conductors to campus with the Lakeside Band Festival over the years, and when it was time to look towards the 140th anniversary and a commission, you start to look towards a certain kind of composer or a certain type of music that might work for the circumstances. And Alex had just written a number of things in this electroacoustic environment where there's an electronic soundtrack that accompanies and actually intermingles with the musicians of the band. And I just thought this was really an interesting approach and something that was worth looking at, and truly enjoyed not only the band music that she had recently written, but all of the things similar to Slipping that was on her chamber music CD that I got to take a listen to. And it was just like the perfect opportunity. And then when I got a chance to meet her and this the true spirit and enthusiastic background to how this might play out, it was pretty obvious that this is the person that we wanted to have write the piece for us.
Where did the two of you meet the first time?
We were at the Midwest Convention in Chicago in December, and that was probably the first time we had a chance to meet. And then I think it was last December we sat down to even talk more about where we were at on the piece and how it was going. And so we've been able to keep in touch through social media and those other kinds of things as well, but that was the first time.
And although this isn't the main story, what we want to talk about, I am just a little curious, and I think people might find it interesting. How does one go about formulating a formal commission from a composer like Alex Shapiro? What are the more basic nuts and bolts that are involved in making something like this happen?
Well, there's a contractual obligation which stipulates the amount that would be involved in producing the work, as well as things like the copying of the parts and executing all of the licensing and things like that. So there's a contractual part. Most of it is honestly just working through the discussion about how the piece might work and securing the timeline, you know, when this might need to be done, And we were so fortunate to have some great support for this venture. Sometimes the hardest thing is just coming up with the funding for this, and a lot of college bands work together in a consortium or college choirs to do advanced pieces with great composers, and that's how the money's collected. Just usually a number of schools go together, but this was something that we were able to do on our own, and I'm very happy about that part.
Absolutely. And I'm anxious to hear more about how this piece really came together, but Alex Shapiro, let's first learn a little bit about you in terms of where you come from. I know that now you make your home on the West Coast, but your biography says you were born and raised in New York City.
I was. I like to say I now live on a much larger island than the one on which I grew up, called Manhattan.
<Yeah.
laughs> The one I'm on now is physically twice the size as Manhattan. But I grew up in Manhattan. I lived there 21 years, from birth to through conservatory, and then left and then moved to Los Angeles. And I lived in L.A. for a whopping 24 years.
Wow.
So, yeah. And then finally I fled about 7 years ago. I'd had enough of the traffic and everything else, and because I don't wave a stick at anybody, and I don't, as a conductor, and I don't play an instrument, no one would ever want to hire me to do that, because I'm only writing notes that everybody else has to do the hard work to bring to life. That means I can live anywhere. Mm. And with my career on the internet, I realized, you know, I can live anywhere. How about San Juan Island, Washington? Because
wow.
I had a friend who moved up to a neighboring island on the Canadian side, because San Juan Island is right on the Canadian border. We like to say we're just to the left of America and slightly north of Canada.
Ah,
and so there I was up on San Juan Island.
And that is, in a sense, a real retreat for you. I remember the day that Dr. Ripley arranged for you to Skype with some of our students. We got a real look at where you live and the natural and unruined beauty that's all around you, and that must be a great place in which to do what you do.
It's outstanding. It's really outstanding. The house that I'm in is right on the edge of the water. I think that's something that Carthage and I have in common. You know, we're both with the water at our feet, and it is incredibly inspiring. I turned my webcam around that day to show everybody, you know, where we were, because I think putting a composer in the context of where he or she is and what affects the way they hear is really significant. I think that has a lot to do with it. And for me, certainly, I mean, you think about all the mixed meters in this piece, Liquid Compass. Well, the ocean is nothing but mixed meters, right? There's nothing regular about those waves, and I think that affects me. I think that affects the way I hear.
Did you grow up in a musical household? I mean, was it just a foregone conclusion that music would be the predominant force in your life?
Oh, no. I think they wanted me to go to Harvard Law like my father. It was a very musical household, in that I was really lucky that both of my parents adored classical music. And it was on all the time. My mother was an amateur and a very fine amateur flutist who studied for many years when I was growing up with John Wummer, who at the time was the principal flutist of the New York Phil.
Whoa.
So my ears were filled for year after year with her practicing 2-3 hours a day. Beautiful tone and all the repertoire. So, boy, do I know flute music.
Mm.
And my father, while he was an attorney by profession, he adored music. He was a walking discography, understood classical music so well, would stand in front of our big KLM floor speakers conducting furiously, you know, like Leonard Bernstein, his hero. And I think that's a great environment. I'd go to bed with Mahler symphonies blasting over these big KLM speakers. And I figured, well, how could you not end up a composer if you're growing up like with that in your ear all the time? So they were great.
It's funny, I was about to ask you, so were you a musician growing up, as though a composer's not a musician, but I think you know what the question means. I mean, you've already touched on the fact that we're not going to hear you playing anything on Saturday night, but I imagine at some point you played something and
did.
Or sang.
Well, it's really funny. I started actually composing when I was 9, not composing well, but composing, and hearing music and working it out on the keyboard. And then when I was 10, I asked my parents, could I have piano lessons? And they said, are you going to practice? And I said, yes, 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 I want piano lessons. So I did become what we call a very proficient composer pianist. And I was up to playing concerti and all that through my high school years. I was a good pianist, but I knew better than to ever think I'd be a gifted one. And but I was writing my whole teenage years, and when I was 15, I had my first formal composition lessons. And growing up in New York City had huge advantages because I had Manus College of Music that particular summer where I went and was wonderfully encouraged with a terrific composer, Leo Edwards, who was so kind to me when I was 15 and just egged me on. And then I went on to Aspen Music School for a couple of summers out in Colorado, which was life-changing. And then I went into Juilliard Pre-College, being a city girl, you know. So that was hugely wonderful as a composition major, and then over to Manhattan School of Music. So it was just this progression, always as a composer, but very happy to be able to play bad piano.
Were you writing things for the piano, or what were those first?
No, my first pieces were actually for strings, which it's funny because to this day I'm terrified of strings. I don't know how they do it. I think strings are just awesomely magical. How do they do it? But anyway, piano is a very easy instrument to play. But I was writing for strings and pretty much anything. I mean, by the time I was 15, the great thing about studying is that they have you writing for every instrument. And you get proficient and you listen a lot. And I think when you're sonically drenched in music all the time, as I was growing up, you have an inherent sense, idiomatically, of what instruments do. And that's sort of how you become a composer. You know?
When I think back to the first things that I composed as a high schooler, the thing that I regret the most is that I didn't know where the wastebasket was. I had a real warped sense of how good things were, that just the fact that I had written this and it has never existed before, it's just somehow made it, you know, a piece of some stature or quality just right there, just because I wrote this thing. And of course, at some point you start to realize that the quality of a piece of music hasn't not a whole lot to do with the fact that you happen to write it.
Oh, yeah.
And eventually you figure out that not everything that flows from your pen is a masterwork. But did you have a better sense of that early on?
No, absolutely not. I think I just loved doing it. To this day, and I've spoken not only to the students at Carthage College in different classes and contexts, but also to Trumper High School. Was it yesterday? Just yesterday.
Right.
It's been quite a week.
Where Dr. Ripley's wife is
exactly.
The director of bands.
Kathy, and she's just fabulous, and the students were wonderful. And to all of them, I say, it is not, most composers, maybe not Mozart, but most of the ones that I know, we all are trying constantly and throwing out ideas and trying over and over and over to get something right when we're starting a piece. It very rarely does it just, you know, zoom out of us. Oh, fantastic. This is brilliant. Here we go. We're done. It doesn't really happen that way except in the movies. And, you know, I wish it were like that in real life. But usually we're just sitting there working things out over and over again, especially at the beginning of a piece, trying to figure out how is it going to start? What's the motive? What's the idea? And finally, after failing many times, we succeed, which means all of that failure is success. And as I said to the students, it's only failure if you try once, don't like it, throw it away, and walk away. That's failure. But right. If you just keep trying, you're going to come up with something. So it takes perseverance.
Particularly as you were first composing, ahead of when you actually started to be formally trained in it, did your music sound like anybody in particular, or did it sound unmistakably like Alex Shapiro right from the start?
The first one, when I was 9, it sounded like Bure, because at the time Masterpiece Theater was on. Isn't it Bure? You know, the big theme that everybody knew, right? And so I was in recorder class at the time. I was in fourth grade, and we all played recorder, and I was a good recordist. I have to say, I love playing the recorder. What an obnoxious sound the soprano recorder was after a while. But anyway, I love playing this thing. So I actually came up with a 4-part arrangement of the Masterpiece Theater theme. I proudly brought it in to my fourth grade teacher, Sylvia Kuferstein, really nice lady, and I said, here, I've written an entire arrangement for recorder class, for the class, you know, let's play this. And she took one look at the piece, and she looked up at me, or really down at me, because I was only 9, I was much shorter, and although she was pretty short. And so we looked at each other eye to eye at 4'9", and she said, oh, this is really lovely, Alex, but nobody is going to be able to play this. We can't do this. So it was my first rejection. But you know what? I was not deterred. I kind of looked at her quizzically. I'm thinking, well, if it's good, why can't they play it? I didn't put it together, you know. And I just went home and I kept writing music and working on my own stuff, too. I think my early stuff probably sounded like a combination of musical theater and Elton John and a little bit of Brahms. I don't know, some demented combination. But there you go, you know.
I've studied composition actually very little. The little I studied it formally was at Luther with Dr. Monhart, mm-hmm. who was somebody that Dr. Ripley would also know. We both went to Luther College. And I remember the first couple times I brought something in written more in his style, I mean, rather than my own, which was pretty derivative. So I was trying to write more starkly modern music that he was really interested in. And,
academic and terse is how I remember it.
Yeah, there you go. And I would bring this in, and he would play through it, and then he would look at Joel Martinson, who was also, we were studying together as a threesome, and he would look at Joel, and he'd say, Bartok. Sounds like Bartok. Or he'd play something else. And naive me thought that was a compliment. Oh, my word, I wrote something that sounds like Bartok. Isn't that great? And, of course, the point was, we already have Bartok. We don't need Bartok again. We need Berg or Martinson or Alex Shapiro. I mean, we need something new said. But so that's what prompted the question,
yeah.
Because I think in many cases, young composers are actually writing someone else's
Absolutely.
Music, they don't even know it.
Most are. And I think it takes a while to develop your own voice, your own ism, as I like to say. Everybody's got their personal preferences of intervals to which they gravitate and just certain sounds and textures. And I've certainly noticed the older I get, the more I have my own, you know, preferences that are, you know, it's sort of my own voice and my own way of putting things together. But you travel through a lot of musical territory to get to that place. And you see it when you do work, when I work with younger composers, when I'm visiting someplace and get to sit down one-on-one with them and look at their scores and try to, you know, push them off the dime of doing something that kind of does sound like everybody else, because they're going to be the first them. And I want to encourage them to go out there and feel like they have permission to sound like anything they want to sound like. They do not have to worry about being in the pocket of anything. And especially in this day and age, musically, I have to say it's very, very different than when I was coming up in school 30-some-odd years ago at this point, which is a frightening number. You know, back in the day in New York, there were really kind of two paths. There was the uptown, more academic, you know, blip-blop kind of stuff going on. It was very hip, you know. But there was the uptown thing, Columbia and Princeton and all that. Then there was the downtown scene, which was, you know, the minimalists and the performance art and the, you know, other stuff. And they were both wonderful. But that was sort of it. And if you were a midtown kind of person, you know, neither downtown or uptown, there wasn't as much room up until the early to mid-80s, I would think. And then things started to shift. And I think that I'm very lucky to be working right now, because I'm such a chameleon in terms of my own voice. I don't think I would have had a career 30 years ago. In fact, I know I wouldn't have, because I went right into commercial music after school. So.
And what does that mean? I mean, explain what you mean by that term.
By commercial music. I got a gig doing, I got several gigs when I was at Manhattan School of Music on the side, just doing low or very little budget documentary scoring. And then I had an opportunity to come out to Los Angeles and do a direct-to-video, you know, horrible project, but it was a reason to come out to L.A. and start working in the film and TV music industry, which I did for about 15 years before I switched over in my late 30s to writing concert music, because I knew very well in the early 80s I wasn't going to be able to get arrested as a concert composer, but I knew I was a composer. I wanted to work as one. At the time, I was very fortunate. I was taking some lessons with John Corigliano, who was at the Manhattan School of Music at the time before he went to Juilliard, and he had just come back from scoring Altered States. And, oh, my goodness, what an amazing score that is. And I remember poring over it with him, page by page, and being stunned by this and realize a very sophisticated score and palette, as his would be. And I remember thinking at the time, aha, doing film music is a way to get really interesting music to audiences with visuals that helps them absorb that music in a different way. And he was very encouraging of me going out to Los Angeles. And so that's, you know, I did that. When I told him I had this opportunity to go, he said, yeah, you should go. That would be a great thing. Because, you know, when you think of it, what's conservatory? It's trade school. The whole point is get a job. So here I was a composer. I got a job. Yeah. And so I stayed there. That's how that happened.
Is there part of you that misses that work, or maybe it's still an occasional part of what you
no,
do.
No, I don't miss it. And in a sense, you know what I get to do with these really big electroacoustic band pieces? I feel like I'm having the final revenge over any film that I wasn't hired for. I'm creating my own film score now. It really, I think a lot of my music could be described that way.
Yeah. There's just no film.
There's just no film. Well, I guess there's one going on in my head a lot of the time, but no one else has to see it, which is probably a good thing. And I just love this huge palette of band, which I came late to. I've only been writing band music for about 6-7 years at the most. And the first band piece, which was commissioned by the U.S. Army, was an acoustic piece. All the others since have been electroacoustic, because I was doing electroacoustic work in my chamber music, and I decided, hey, why not put them together and create this vast sound? Because I was so taken aback with the power of band to begin with, having written for many years, I was writing just chamber music for small ensembles. And suddenly, when I got turned on to the band world, I thought, I have died and gone to heaven. This is it. So add a track to that, and suddenly you don't need a director or a producer to hire you. You can do your own thing.
That's cool. For those of you just joining us, we have in the studios here at WGTD for the morning show composer Alex Shapiro, who has been commissioned by the Carthage College. I'm not sure who to say. Did Carthage itself commission, or the music department commission, or... How do we say this?
It's really the larger college that took part in it. There were substantial contributions through the music department, certainly. There was a very generous donation that came from Ralph Lane, who was a Racine resident, and also an anonymous donor. But we had great support from a number of alumni and friends. And so it's really a college commission.
Great. So let's say that Carthage College has commissioned a brand new work to celebrate the 140th anniversary of the bands. And so this piece, this brand new piece receiving its world premiere tomorrow night at 7:30, is called A Liquid Compass. So the composer of it, Alex Shapiro, is with us, as is Dr. James Ripley, the director of instrumental music at Carthage College. Alex Shapiro, as we're talking about this, what you've gravitated towards now, writing pieces for band with electronic music woven into the mix, I'm realizing that some of the most powerful experiences of my life have involved experiencing that as an audience member. I think of my sophomore or junior year at college hearing the orchestra at Orchestra Hall of Luther play Pines of Rome by Ottorino Respighi, and that incredible moment towards the end of the third movement when this shimmery orchestral music is suddenly enhanced by the recorded sound of nightingales singing. And here's something done, I don't know, 1926 or 1927, way back. But in a sense, you're taking what, and of course other composers have, but you among them, are taking this extraordinary idea that Mr. Respighi had all those decades ago, almost a century ago, and creating similar kinds of wonderful combinations.
Yeah, except he didn't have to put up with computers crashing.
Right. Just the reel-to-reel. Or I don't even know what they used.
I don't know what he
used.
Was doing.
I think it came out as a record initially. Yeah. I think it was like a 78 record or something like that for that original thing. It's very different now. You know, I've got my computer there. There's an audio interface. There's all of the amplifiers and speakers and thankfully, Alex is there to help fine-tune it all.
Wow. Well, this is probably the moment we should talk about the actual construction of this particular piece. First of all, how did we... I know the piece is about 9 minutes long. How did that happen to be? Was that at some point something specified in the commission or something you thought that was a good idea?
Jim asked for 8 minutes, and then I called him up because a composer, one of the rules of commissions is you always want to be straight with people if you're going to run over or under. I mean, you don't want to run under. That's not cool. But if you run over, even a minute, if programming being what it is on a concert, you don't want to take for granted that you're just so great that they'll just keep going. So I said to Jim as I was getting very close to the end, I said, you know, I wrote him an email. Would it be okay if I went a minute or two longer? I was looking at possibly even 10 minutes at the time. And he said, great, go. And I felt very relieved. So it ended up being a 9-minute piece.
Wow.
Yeah,
the formulation was kind of on ideas and a little bit of a program or a story or something like that that was shared. Alex kept asking me, you know, what is this going to be about? Or, you know, can you give me some ideas? So I wrote down a few things, and those morph their way into the piece in some ways and others. But the idea was, you know, a lot of what we have to play in the band world tilts at about 4 and 5 minutes, and then it seems like it's done. And it doesn't really seem like it gives enough time to percolate sometimes. And I wanted to let this story and let this music have a chance to do what it needed to. So that's kind of why I came up with 8 minutes initially, and then was happy to go to 9.
And I'm so glad about that, because when I think about what I ended up writing, I wouldn't have been able to accomplish that in 4 or 5 minutes. I really did need the throw of time, this linear space to be able to go there emotionally. Mm. I remember when we started, I asked Jim a lot of questions. I did a lot of research, a lot of reading Carthage's mission statement, Carthage's history. I asked Jim, what was the initial instrumentation of the 1873 band? Mm. You know, what was that? And I put in the score, there's a little moment, there's a few measures where I'm just using that handful of instruments.
Oh, that's cool.
And, you know, there are little tips of the hat I use in the piece. I said to Jim at one point, can you send me the school's alma mater? You have an alma mater, right? He said, oh, yeah. I said, I'm so touched that so many of the alumni, you know, chipped in to donate to this fund, to bring this piece to life. I'm so touched by that. Would the alumni know the alma mater? Jim said, oh, yeah. I said, great, send me the PDF of the music. So I'm playing through it. I'm thinking, you know, it's like most alma maters. It's just sort of a hymn, and it's fairly milquetoast. You know, there's nothing terribly striking about it. But I decided, you know, those first two notes, which is just a third, I decided I'm going to make a little allusion to the alma mater throughout and use that as a motif in the piece. And so I was able to win that through and different ways of personalizing this piece so that it, even though it's going to be played by many bands, the fact that this was written very much for Carthage, that I care and respect them so much, I've been so touched. Working with Jim has been amazing. He's been an absolute joy. He's a fantastic musician and such a great guy and brings out the best in these students. And it was such an honor for me to be able to do this for the school, that what I could bring to it, that would be very much about the school and the essence of it, the traveling, the journeying. This school has moved 4 times, as you know, before landing on the gorgeous shores of Lake Michigan here. And so the compass aspect, I mean, the title has to do with finding your true north and finding a directional heading. In the mission statement, it talks about truth and the seeking truth. And I think that that's what we do when we're journeying. We're looking for what resonates and what's authentic. So, and the liquid part has many levels. You know, the liquid is very allegorical in a lot of ways. Water is. And here we are on the water. I'm on the water. Carthage is on the water. There's a slightly baptismal quality to what it is to rebirth and to journey. And there's a sister school in Japan that Jim has had a long relationship with. And I wanted to, he and I talked about that connected waterway, in a sense, between Lake Michigan and the river that the school is on.
Right. All the time that we go to our rehearsals in Japan, we have to take this bridge across that river as well. So it's just how we're all interconnected, and water is such a big part of that.
Lovely. So liquid compass comes from that.
Love it. Yeah. Let me ask you yet another mundane question. I mean, somewhat related to how long should this piece be, is just how hard should this piece be? I'm really curious to know how you knew, or if you knew, what the Carthage musicians were capable of doing, or by and large are collegiate bands of a certain level of proficiency that you as a composer commissioned to write something wouldn't need to worry so much about specific skill level.
I think it's good for a composer to think about that. I think, you know, you think a lot in terms of range and in terms of what are you asking their tired lips to do for extended periods of time. You know, you do think about that. As it turns out, this particular piece, just because of the nature of the music that I wanted to put forward, is not that taxing. It's not a virtuosic piece. It wasn't set out. I didn't set out to write one like that. It's a very expressive piece. So it is within the grasp, I think, of a pretty wide swath of colleges. I didn't have to say to Jim, okay, you know, how great is your first trumpet? You know, can they play in the stratosphere for 25 measures? Mm. You know, I didn't have to go there. That wasn't a necessary move artistically. You think artistically, but you always, as a working composer, you always want to think about who are the musicians playing this, and I want to make them look good. I want to make everybody look good with my choices on this.
And it turned out just great. It's almost perfectly situated for our students and certainly the chapel, because it does have these beautiful moments and long extended opportunities for beauty, and the chapel is not a quiet place, you know. It even though it's a serene place, it's not a quiet place, and so these sounds ring, you know, throughout the space, and the ending's fantastic. The ending is great, and also the electronics, you know, come in and out of the sound of the band as well, and kind of, you know, ring throughout the space as it goes, and it was intentionally to take advantage of the acoustics in the chapel, and just the whole spirit of the thing just seems to fit so well for the kids as well as for the space.
I wonder about, and I think I'm asking this more on behalf of listeners looking in from the outside on these kind of collaborations. What potential is there for a commission like this to be launched, and then for you to not like it? I mean, what if Alex Shapiro had emailed you a few sketches, the electronic equivalent of sketches, and you would have thought, I mean, I know this is an if, I know you love the piece, but isn't that always the chance you take when you pay a composer for something that doesn't yet exist? What if she had come up with something that didn't fit, or that you just simply didn't like? Were you at all worried about that, or is that just beyond the realm of possibility because of who Alex Shapiro is?
Oh, well, never beyond the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I guess it's always an option. The thing about it is you have to be careful about who you're going to ask to write, and especially on a big commission like this, you want to. That's why, you know, I asked Alex. We talked about this at Tremper the other day, where there's writers and there's composers, and you think about composing yourself, just that word, what that means to compose something, and there's a certain sense of centeredness that comes. You have to kind of have this inner thought and inner feeling and inner inspiration about something, and when you compose yourself, where you compose music, there's a centeredness about it, and then there's a uniqueness about it, and a voice that happens, and you both know what that's like. And then there's writers, and we weren't going to commission a writer. We were going to commission a composer. So I felt very good about Alex's music in the past, as well as how this might go. So I was never worried for a second that it wouldn't be terrific. And even when she sent the MIDI demo of this, you know, a kind of an electronic sampling of how it might sound, 4 times I got goosebumps the first time I listened to it.
Wow.
It was just great.
And I have to say, for any composer, what a moment of relief it is, the ultimate exhale, when you deliver the piece and you hear back from the band director that he loves it, because you're waiting on pins and needles, thinking, oh my goodness, what if I messed up? What if he doesn't hear it the way I'm hearing it, or doesn't think it's going to be effective? Or, you know, I think most composers are filled with self-doubt, no matter how experienced they are, and it doesn't go away. If you're always hoping that the sonic insanity and chaos in your head is going to translate to somebody else, and there's not a guarantee that it will. It is a risk. I mean, I think that to commission a composer is a great act of faith, and it is a wonderful, it's a huge, it's an incredible gift to the composer to have somebody say, I believe in you, I believe in your artistic vision, I'm going to give you free rein, because that's what it is. It's not like in commercial music. When you do a film score, the director comes in and says, okay, that cue works, that one doesn't, change that, I don't like those shiny instruments over there, you know, whatever. They're ripping it apart, and it's your job, it's part of the craft, to redo it, because they're the boss, okay? But in concert music, it's very different. As you guys know, nobody comes in and really edits it's us. we are entrusted, and sometimes that could be a mistake, but we're entrusted to use our own judgment and our own self-assessment to say, okay, this is going to work, this isn't going to work, I'm throwing this out, I'm reworking that, you know. And then a few months later, we come out with the piece. And that is a big leap of faith, too, but it is a very wonderful thing to be given that permission.
You know what's really fascinating here? The first thing I was going to say is, now I understand why you don't miss that. That is the film business,
yep,
where you take music in and then the director is the boss,
right,
that says, oh, that this has to be much more reticent, and oh, no, this is so boring or whatever. They're the boss. You constantly retool it so it meets their specifications and needs and desires and so on. So the first thing I was going to say is, oh, no wonder you don't miss that because, you know, now you're the boss. But on the other hand, I bet there probably is a tiny bit of you that misses that in the sense that of what you were just talking about, that you're in an entirely different line of work where ultimately this is your music with no one standing over your shoulder, and yet there's no one standing over your shoulder.
It's a tightrope walk.
It's a huge responsibility.
It is, and I take it very, very seriously. But that's also why I'm a pretty good communicator. And, you know, throughout the process, I was in touch with Jim. I remember writing him. I forget what it was. I ran into him at something, and I said, I've got the piece. It's going to do this. It's going to do that. I have this idea of what I'm doing. Like, I get very excited about sharing sort of the process when I have an inkling of where I'm going with something. I might not have the notes, but I'll have the idea of the roadmap of it. And I tend to stay in good communication with whoever I'm writing for because I want them to feel comfortable. I don't want them to be scared that, oh my goodness, she's gone away for months. I've never heard from her. I have no idea what's going on. I'm the opposite. So I think that's part of the process too, is the human contact and the human relationship. And I've said this a lot to the students this week. I talk a great deal about this in general, that we may think we're in the music making business, but we're in the relationship making business. It's very, very important that everything we do, and it doesn't matter what your job is, whether you're a composer, a dentist, an architect, a plumber, whatever you are, it's really comes down to how do you relate to people. And I think that in my dealings with Jim, in my dealings now with the students in rehearsal, you know, I would like to be kind, even if I need more of something from them. I'm not going to yell at them. I want to bring out the best in them. And we're all individuals. We're all collaborating. We're all making music together. And the relationship that we have with the people surrounding us in our life, no matter what we're doing, is the most important thing.
Mm.
And our humanness and our graciousness and kindness, those are what the things that matter the most. And then the music flows out of that.
Hmm. Jim, tell us about the first time the band played this, which, of course, was long before Alex Shapiro came to town. But tell us about, and I sound like I'm asking you something that I know the answer to. I don't have any idea when that was or what that felt like. When was that and what was that like?
The first time that we actually engaged in the music making part of the equation was actually kind of artificial because it didn't have the whole piece. We started with just the band parts. Mm. And because that whole integration is so important, I think their sense was one of kind of a partial view, a piecemeal sense of, well, this is it, and boy, there's a lot of extended kind of long line playing, and I think, I hope I was correct in getting it started. We just started talking about the last chord first, and you know that it finally actually settles in E flat major at the end, although there's another Shapiro note that's in there as well, you know, that it never really kind of settles completely all the way through it, because the idea, even at the end, is that it's going forward. It doesn't, the piece doesn't rest. It's always moving forward. And so we kind of started with that, and I unpacked some other things as far as the harmonies, because some of those were also unusual for their ears. And we just talked about that first, and then we started to work through the various sections. And in a lot of ways, that's one of the reasons why I love contemporary music as much as I do. We kind of have to explore the language for the students first, and then they kind of get into the piece. And so it does sometimes feel like a really nice crossword puzzle of putting it together and putting it together and putting it together. And then finally you get to a point where it's like, okay, you get the puzzle now. But now, you know, we need to put the brocade inside all of this and just let it settle. And that's, you know, what we've been doing this week.
One of the interesting things along the lines of what Jim's saying regarding putting it together, and they started, they had the track, but they wanted to run the band first and, you know, get their sound together. And what I often say to bands when they are doing an electroacoustic piece is that it, the analogy is very much, back to Hollywood, it's very much the green screen effect. You know, when an actor is being shot, just in front of a green, sometimes blue, screen.
Because Godzilla's not there yet.
Exactly. Right. Godzilla and all of New York City is not there yet. But the actor has to do their best, or actors, to make it seem very exciting and do all the acting. And meanwhile, all that's in front of them is some guy with a boom and a cigarette, you know, bored, looking at his watch, wondering when the union's going to let him go home, you know. But in back of him, he has to, or she has to, assume that there's going to be this remarkable scene. And so that is the analogy, because I say to the students, you know, you're sitting in the middle, you know, of the band. You can't, even on the best of circumstances, it's hard for them to hear, even with an acoustic piece, what the end effect is and the end result out to the audience. They can't really hear that as well. But certainly with an electroacoustic piece, where so much of the band sound is coming through the speakers in terms of this other section of the band called the audio track, which is an equal section of the band, they can't really hear that. They've got stage monitors, but they can't really hear it that well. And so they have to trust that they're creating a full sound that they can't hear themselves. And that takes a little bit of psychological coaching, and it's very much that green screen effect. Like, trust in it, it's going to be fabulous. You know, the audience is going to be getting a whole different experience of this than they are.
What has your primary function been this week? You've been at Carthage since Tuesday. What role have you, and maybe I should ask you first, come to think of it. I know you have been more than a figurehead. Oh, there's the composer who wrote this thing that we are playing. I know your role has been more crucial.
The thing that we wanted to do was to help our students, first of all, understand how this piece was going to come to realize itself by bringing in Alex herself to really get that idea. So most of the time has been spent with the band and working with the different ideas, and she's been great to listen and then come back to talk with the kids in just a great way about, you know, making this music so wonderful. But she's also been able to visit with various Carthage classes, the music industry and technology class. That was a natural fit. But also she'll be meeting with the Composers Club Obligato on Wednesday or Friday.
Today.
Oh, my gosh,
yeah,
it's Friday.
And
then there were other things for the kids at Tremper, but to just be the person who can talk about what she does and what music and the composer-performer relationship is like. So she's had a chance to get around a little
it's
bit.
It's been wonderful. I feel like my job is to encourage everybody else that they all can do this if they want to, that music is inside of each one of them, and that even if they don't end up going into music education or music performance, they're always going to be musicians and they're always going to be music lovers. That's the message, and to keep the joy in it for them, because especially by the end of the school year, everybody's exhausted and they've got tests and they've got all this stuff going on. I really am sympathetic to that, so I want to bring in this outside blast of joy and permission and encouragement to them that this is a wonderful
thing. Because
it's
not the end of the semester for you, is it?
No, it never is. I have so many pieces coming up. Yeah, it's never the end, which is a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you can come in removed from, you're describing the end of the semester very, very well. But, I can see how you can come in not weighed down by that.
Right.
And I know from talking to some of the students that they have absolutely loved having you here and are thrilled to be playing this brand new piece. Jim, real quick, describe what's going to happen Saturday night's concert.
The 140th anniversary celebration starts with the concert band and their conductor, Dr. Margaret Young Weitzel. They'll be performing three works, and then a short intermission, and then the wind orchestra will play Alex's piece directly after intermission, and then some other selections after that kind of encapsulate the tradition of the band over time. There is a a birthday cake for a reception following, which will be fun. But 7:30 in the Siebert Chapel, and program will last a little over an hour, maybe an hour 15 minutes. It's meant to be a nice celebration and way to kick off a really remarkable year. The band has had a lot of things that have kept us hopping.
Yeah, it's been an exciting time for sure. I thought, if it's okay, Alex Shapiro, I'm going to play a little bit of Tight Squeeze.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is an example of a piece with wind band and, and track combined together.
Exactly.
Something reminiscent to what you, although by no means is this similar music
no,
to a Liquid
very different.
Compass, something entirely different, receiving its world premiere Saturday night again, 7:30 in Siebert Chapel. Alex Shapiro, what a thrill to meet you and to talk with you today, and very best wishes with all that you're going to create from this point on, and thank you for being here, and thank you for this wonderful new work, which we're all going to enjoy tomorrow night.
Thank you so much, Greg.
And
great.
Dr. James Ripley, great to have you here as always.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
Let's finish out here with a minute or so of Alex Shapiro's Tight Squeeze. And coming up on Monday's morning show, we'll be talking about the upcoming event in downtown Kenosha, which celebrates the craft of beer making. We'll be talking to Matt Geary, who has his own beer making business in downtown Kenosha, and talking about what's going to be unfolding and at this upcoming beer festival. Next week, we have other really interesting conversations that we're excited about, including a preview of the production of Les Miserables, which is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild, and also an exciting concert coming up by the Choral Arts Society, which will feature a number of different local composers and their music, a concert which is called Locally Grown. We'll give you a full schedule of the morning show for next week in just a few minutes. We want to remind you that WGTD's morning show is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Our weather forecast calls for cloudy skies and intermittent rain this morning, but we should have sunshine by this afternoon with a high temperature of 73 degrees. Tonight we'll have clear skies, mild conditions with a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow Saturday should be gorgeous with mostly sunny skies and a high of 73 degrees. And it looks like Sunday will cloud up again, a 50% chance of rain. We'll have a high right around 79.